Hey, Brandon Lynette here. This is Faith and Fire, God and Country. And I feel like I really have still just been kind of holding back and softening a few of my edges. A little bit of trauma from a voice from someone that has sat across from me in the show, kind of just made me feel like I was too much and too edgy. But I'm kind of done with the qualifiers and the diplomatic framing and the careful language that everybody uses to make sure that nobody on either side gets too uncomfortable. Okay. What is the truth? The American people are fucking exhausted. You already know what I'm going to say because you've been thinking it, so we may as well just say it. Okay. Two quick things before we get into this episode today. Super patch, liberty and freedom every single day. If you have chronic pain, you are going to take this and you're going to thank me later because all those prescriptions, you're going to get some respite from that. Show notes, check that for the link, okay? If you guys haven't tuned in, Listen Bitch Podcast, I just put up episode like 596 today. I believe it is my last of the rebellion season, and we're just going to go back to where we were. Go ahead and find that show and binge season 10 because I think it was a great, great clearing for what's to come. And yeah, no trigger warning for y'all. I think we should just go full throttle today. And I'll start with something that should have been the lead story on every network in America last week, and it wasn't. Okay. Why wasn't this? Someone tried to kill the president again. Sorry, tried to kill the president of the United States, the vice president, at a UFC at the UFC fight on the White House lawn. UFC Freedom 250 was held on the South Lawn of the White House. Thousands of attendees. The plan was to fly small drones loaded with explosives over the north side of the area to trigger chaos and force an evacuation, pushing crowds south, where snipers would then open fire on the roughly 4,000. 300 or so attendees, targeting Trump and Vance and members of Congress and prominent business figures. The group had already mapped entry points. They marked sniper positions with purple dots on a map, identified drone deployment zones, and discussed guerrilla-style warfare training. The ringleader was a 31-year-old man named Abraham Hermosillo Alvarez, operating under the alias Shepherd. An encrypted chat apps. Okay. He lives in Omaha, Nebraska, operating out of an abandoned church building that he owned in western Nebraska. Court records confirm he is not a United States citizen. The DOJ has not confirmed his legal immigration status. He recruited from multiple states. Upwards of like two dozen people were identified in the online chat. Five were arrested. They considered additional targets, including power grids and pro-Israel legislatures. Okay. And this is how the FBI found out about it. A 19-year-old named, I don't know if it's Tyson Proper from Danville, Ohio, had been stockpiling firearms, thousands of rounds and tactical gear. His mother got concerned about his online activity. So on June 10th, she called the FBI. His mother, a concerned American mother, saved the lives of the President of the United States and thousands of people at a fight night. Not a government algorithm, not a surveillance program, but a mother who was paying attention to her child. And they caught these people. They are facing, obviously, life in prison. The event happened. I will say I watched it and the fight night was incredible. It was incredibly patriotic and just it was amazing, like where they honored people and our servicemen, current, our veterans, first responders, all of it. Just it was incredible. If you guys don't know history in the White House, I urge you to look into it because they used to hold bare knuckle fights there. People are like, they've turned it into a spectacle. Y'all, some of these presidents went crazy in the White House. So do a little history, okay? But yeah, the fight night was incredible. And this story, buried under sports scores and political drama is that someone tried to murder the leadership of the country at a public event and the FBI stopped them because of a mother from Ohio who noticed something wrong. This is the thing. stop handing over your kids' current education and future. Stay involved with your kids' lives. Know their online activity. Pay attention because you might be the person who stops the next big thing. Might be the person that stops the next big thing. I mean, I could go on about the fight night, okay? I could go on and on and on about it. I know a lot of people are in an uproar because of a comment that was made. And I just think after everything that I personally even have been through with the name calling, a bigot, a racist, a fascist, like, I mean, the names come and I've been told to kill myself in my inbox. And I've watched people mock Charlie Kirk's death. I've watched people mock, the First Lady. I watched people mock Trump the entire time. I've seen people have him hanging from gallows and mocking his death. I've heard them call for his murder. So when someone comes on there and says something that the whole world, minus like 20 people, the whole world is thinking it, that the former First Lady is not a lady at all. He says that, and the world goes crazy. And it was a joke. It was hilarious. We've all thought it. We've all said it out loud. And the truth is, like, they could sue. They've been able to be able to sue for a very long time. In fact, even Trump has sued several times for stuff just like this. And I just want you to ask the question, because if they sue, all she has to do is prove, that she's a woman. And they've never done that. They've never sued. So I'm just asking the question, like, first of all, it's that serious. If it's that hurtful or that bothersome, there would be action that was taken and there's not. But after the hateful stuff, I really don't have guilt in laughing for the joke, but it fired everybody up. Something I talked about last week, the day it happened, and I actually didn't even get to see the sentencing part. I just knew that he was found guilty. Okay, so we talked about that. We're talking about Carmelo Anthony. And yeah, the story is not over. After I was done recording, I jumped online and saw that he got 35 years. The Collin County jury sentenced Carmelo Anthony to 35 years in prison for the murder of Austin Metcalf. They absolutely rejected the sudden passion argument that would have reduced the sentence. So he got the 35 years. Metcalf's family finally has a number to attach to what was taken from them. And I think, it doesn't bring their son back, but maybe they find solace in knowing there is a killer off the streets. I couldn't imagine what it felt like for them because I thought of that. I thought, like, how would I feel knowing that my son's killer is just out free this whole time? Like, my son is in the ground dead and this killer's walking in. I think it would drive me crazy. So hope they have a little bit of closure and peace. And knowing that he was held accountable. But listen to me, we're getting immediately after the sentencing, a Texas Department of Criminal Justice parole supervisor. Her name's Donna Robinson. She posted on Facebook identifying herself as a state employee. She said that Carmelo Anthony would be protected in prison, that she personally would make sure of it, that she did not give. And I'm going to say what she said exactly. She, that she did not give a fuck about the family's loss. That was her exact statement. She said it was time for these fucking bigots to feel the pain that they've inflicted on other groups of people since the beginning of time. She said, let them start burying their own. Like, those are quotes. I'm not paraphrasing what she said. Those are her genuine quotes. She was a parole supervisor, meaning she made decisions about who gets released back into your community and who doesn't. And she's done this for over a decade. Fired. She is fired now. The Texas Department of Criminal Justice confirmed it, citing that her statements were incompatible with the TDCJ policy and values and demonstrate bias and a lack of the impartiality essential to the fair administration of justice in Texas. I'm glad she's fired. I mean, obviously, that's the obvious right call. Obvious right call. But I need to ask the question that her firing raises. She was there for a decade making parole decisions while carrying the belief that white people deserve to feel pain because they're white. That's all. Good, bad, who cares? You're white. You deserve pain. While viewing her government role as an opportunity to protect certain people and punish others based on race. For a decade, she had this power. How many decisions did she make in that time that were contaminated by that view? How many other Donna Robinsons are there in the criminal justice system right now who haven't posted publicly? The firing is good, but my questions do not go away because she's been fired. And I tread lightly when it especially on this show when I talk about race. Like, I try to be precise, I try to tiptoe, but what I really try to do and try to understand is we have to distinguish between race and culture. It's the same thing. Every race has a terrible whatever. Every race. Like, there's terrible white people, there's terrible black people, there's terrible Mexicans, there's terrible Chinese. Like, there's also really great white people. There's also really great black people. So this is the thing. We separate that and we stop making it about the color of the skin and we talk about culture. And that's what I want to do today is to get you guys to understand that what I talk about today when I'm talking about this, it's not about the color of skin. It's not about black people, all the black people. It is about a specific culture that is destroying black people and everyone around it, and it's costing lives. And everybody just continues to pretend that it isn't happening. Are you kidding me? After the Carmelo Anthony verdict, social media blew up with posts about Austin Metcalf. AI-generated images of him in a grave, captions calling him a dead loser, people making pictures of themselves urinating on his grave. A social media account nicknamed, he's like the Black Tucker Carlson or something, that's what he says, posted about killing America, about white people needing to feel pain, about celebrating the death of a 17-year-old boy who was stabbed at a track meet because he asked some because he was asked to leave the team's tent or ask someone to leave his team's tent. Jonathan Pettigrew, 41-year-old man, father of seven, I believe, in the Bronx. He just bought his first house. He's on a bus. He asked a 15-year-old to stop talking loudly on his phone, and he was shot and killed. No protest, no national outrage from civil rights organizations, no screaming demands that Black Lives Matter, nothing. Because the person who shot Jonathan Pettigrew was not the right color to make his death politically useful. His life mattered. Pettigrew's life mattered. He was a father of seven. He just bought his first house, y'all. And he died because he asked a teenager to lower his voice on public transportation. This is crazy to me. I literally, when I'm scrolling to look for headlines today, and I see this lady in a doctor's office, and she's white, and it's not her recording. It's like another person in the doctor's waiting room. It's a doctor's office, y'all. Across from her, this guy, he's probably my age, between 40 and 50, playing loud ass music, like loud ass music in a waiting room. Loud ass music. And all she said is, "Sir, can you turn that down?" Oh my God, he goes off on her. And he's like, "I'm gonna have my girlfriend beat your ass." And I mean, he's a grown ass man, like my age. Yes, he went crazy with the race card. Yes, he's wild and he's screaming at her. And I'm just like, how is this normal? And this kid, this 15-year-old kid, you guys. Ugh. This 15-year-old kid. I want to say something about this teenager, about what it means that a 15-year-old had a gun on a bus. That a 15-year-old's response to a reasonable request from a stranger was to shoot him. What produces a 15-year-old who does that? What culture? What environment? What absence of structures and home life and consequences and accountability produces a child who shoots a man for asking him to be quieter? What culture is creating that? There's a pattern. Are we going to pretend it doesn't exist? Are we going to pretend it doesn't exist because we don't want to hurt people's feelings? This isn't even a race conversation. It is culture conversation. And the culture I'm describing is destroying the people it claims to represent. They destroy each other and nobody cares. Where's Black Lives Matter in Chicago when I know that guess what's going to happen this weekend? Should we make a bet on how many numbers? How many people die in Chicago? Black on black violence? Should we talk about that? They're glorifying violence, the celebration of predatory behavior, the mockery of victims. This is the greatest part, though, the absolute rejection of personal responsibility. Where was the responsibility from Carmelo and his family? I tell my husband this the other day. I'm like, I don't even know what I would do if we were in this position and say our child did something horrific and hurt someone else. I'd be on my knees, like, all apology. I am so sorry. I don't understand. And we would take the responsibility, the ownership. Never once. I didn't see this family. I didn't see Carmelo. None of them took any responsibility. Nothing. There's no remorse. There is nothing. Where does that come from? The normalization of incarceration is a rite of passage. Data doesn't lie. You can look at the statistics, it doesn't lie. The hostility toward anyone who builds, saves, earns, or achieves. It's not racist to name that. It's ignorant to call me racist. It's honest, though. And the people being destroyed most by that culture, you know who's, it's crazy to me. It's the young black men who grow up inside of it, who deserve better from the adults around them, who deserve fathers and structure and standards and accountability and personal responsibility in a community that told them the truth. The entitlement, the disrespect, the loudness, it is a culture. And I'm telling you right now, culture is a choice. It is not a racial destiny, it is a choice, which means it can change. Which means calling it out is not cruelty, it's the beginning of the change. It's the beginning of the change. But we can't talk about that because instead, if we continue with the whole race card, then politicians can get richer quicker because we're useful idiots. We're useful idiots. And while we're talking about the culture of predation, let me give you the counter narrative. The one the media doesn't want you to see. Louisiana, 54-year-old man named Glenn Sullivan Sr. This Glenn Sr. repeatedly raped a 14-year-old girl and it resulted in her pregnancy. He pled guilty. Judge William Dykes sentenced him to 50 years in prison and then ordered the physical removal of his testicles as part of the plea agreement. Surgical castration is what they call it. Under Louisiana's tough new laws targeting child sex offenders, Sullivan chose surgery over additional prison time. One of the first instances of court-mandated surgical castration in the state for this type of offense. I think that's great. If you want to know what a consequence looks like, that's a consequence. Now, in my mind, and I don't make that a secret on the show at all. I think if you mess with a kid, that is a death penalty. I mean, you're condemned already in the Bible. It's a thing. It's a thing. I don't think you should be able to continue to walk around or, you know, I just can't even imagine what darkness is inside of him to have done what he did so many times. And I think just castrating him is probably not enough. It's not enough. Is he going to continue to consume the content, share the content? There's a lot of things you could do. And I think that's still a scary thought, but still on the right track, we're getting closer. I think we're getting closer to an answer, but there is some accountability. There's a consequence. Maybe people will think twice about this. And then in my state, House passed its House Bill 4467, and that's the Protecting Minors from Chemical and Surgical Mutilation Act. Banning sex transition surgeries on minors, banning Puberty blockers prescribed to alter a child's sex characteristics, banning cross-sex hormones for the same purpose. It passed, but let me tell you something. Every single Democrat voted against it. Not some of them, not most of them, every single one. These are the same people who tell you that they care about children. They voted against protecting children from irreversible surgical procedures and lifelong pharmaceutical dependency, every single one of them. That vote is in their record, and I just want you to be aware of that when you go to the voting booth in November. Please remember, every single one of them do not care about your kids, and that is what they base their whole foundation on. They love them. They're the love and the acceptance, but no, they're not. It is the party of demons, and please remember that when you go to the ballots, okay? I want to talk about the Southern Poverty Law Center. Okay, I brought them up before. I spilled the tea, but this is like too good to be true. Except it is completely true, my friends. The SPLC has spent decades labeling organizations. Okay, do you guys remember? I've talked about this. And they've spent decades labeling organizations and individuals as hate groups. They have been the arbiter of who's a racist, who is a white supremacist, who deserves to have their reputation destroyed, their bank accounts deplatformed, their speakers disinvited. Their annual hate map has been used to justify everything from social media censorship to violence against organizations they listed. The Department of Justice indicted the SPLC in April. That's when I'm talking to you guys about this. It's a superseding indictment, came in June, that just came out. 11 criminal counts, six of wire fraud, four of false statements to a federally insured bank, one of conspiracy to commit concealment of money laundering. Here's what they did. Heidi Burick, I don't know how you say her name, she's their former director of intelligence, the woman responsible for producing the hate reports. She's the woman whose job was literally to identify hate groups, was allegedly sharing bank accounts with a house with a top informant inside the National Alliance, a white supremacist organization. We're talking like the Black Lives Matter people, okay? She allegedly transferred $140,000 of SPLC donor money into those accounts between 2015 and 2021. The organization that called everyone else a hate group was allegedly funding one. The organization that told you which voices need to be silent was bankrolling the people it claimed to be fighting. You guys see how much racism has been set up in this country, and you're a useful idiot. Prosecutors say the organization was not dismantling hate groups, it's manufacturing and supporting extremism by funding leaders within them. Does it make sense now? There's a word for that. It's called racket, and the racket has now been indicted. It has been indicted. I saw Thomas Massie up again, the man they spent, he $34 million to remove from Congress. He posted something that I feel like I want to comment on because a lot of people are fans of him. I'm not saying I'm not, but I'm also not. I don't know how to say it. But he's talking about how Republicans are in charge because we promised to make America healthy again, to start no new wars, to put people above corporations, to put America above foreign countries, to release the files, to not spy on citizens, to eliminate fraud. And he said his words were, "What the hell happened?" And I want to answer this question with honesty, okay? No excuses, but like truly, can we get honest? Because a lot of people don't research any of this stuff and they just see a viral post or they see someone they like and they take their word as whatever it is. And some of what happened is that the promises were real and the system's fighting them at every level. Like Doge found real fraud, real billions, the regulatory rollback is real. The child trafficking arrests are real. 7,200 children rescued under this administration. Epstein documents are being released more than any under any previous administration. Like no one ever put these out. You guys know they've had them for 20 years, 22 years. They've had these files. You know that? Like every president in the past 22 years had a chance to be able to release this, and no one ever has. We've done that. The deportations are real. The border is being enforced. Iran is at the table. The tariff conversation is being held for the first time in a century. And some of what happened is that the donor class doesn't go away just because you win an election. Do you guys understand that? The pedophile elites that are eating babies and sacrificing kids and running the show, that the $34 million they spent to remove Massey was not an anomaly. Every legislator who would have pushed further, asked harder, demanded the unredacted version is now watching what happened to Massey and making calculations. They're doing that. I am telling you, a president can only do what the system built around him will permit. He has a ceiling. And when the system built around him includes people who have been in these rooms for decades, who have their own files and their own deals and their own entanglements, the ceiling is lower than the promises suggested. And you don't know what you're facing in the arena until your ass is in the arena. So you think you can do these things, and then you realize that these elites, the disgusting families that have been running the country, the demonic sacrifices that are being made, all of this stuff, they have been working for a very long time to protect their system and to protect themselves. I feel like they only allow so much. They give you a little bit of hope, but the devil is busy. I still believe in the disruption. I still believe that this is better than the alternative. And I think Massey's question deserves to be asked out loud by everybody from a place of accountability and not just like performance. I want the clicks and likes. Let's think about every pissed off, Republican right now. No, let's have the real conversation. And the truth is, he got elected president and then they handcuffed his hands behind his back and he can only do so much. But keep asking the questions, keep demanding the accountability. How do we, the people, help break the ceiling that the elites have for anybody who's going to be president? You're bought and paid for. I want to talk about the San Francisco Giants because I love the story. In a way, I'm going to tell you guys, June 12th, 2026, it's Pride Night at Oracle Park. Every Giants player is required to wear a cap with the team logo displayed in rainbow colors celebrating Pride Month. The players have to wear the hat. They don't get a choice about the hat. Three pitchers. It's Landon Roop. Do I say his name right? JT Brubaker and Ryan Walker decided to write something on their hats. They wrote Bible verses. Roop wrote Genesis 9, 12 through 16. And it, What this says, 9, 12 through 16, this is the sign of the covenant I am making between me and you and every living creature with you, a covenant for all generations to come. I have set my rainbow in the clouds, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Whenever I bring clouds over the earth and the rainbow appears in the clouds, I'll remember my covenant between me and you and of living creatures and of every kind. Never again will the waters become a flood to destroy all of life. Whenever the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and all the living creatures of every kind of earth. They put the rainbow's original meaning on the rainbow hat. God made the rainbow. God named the rainbow. God assigned the rainbow its meaning as his covenant of mercy with all of creation. And these players were forced to wear someone else's symbol. They wrote its original author's explanation of what it actually means on the front. So MLB warns them, said it violated uniform rules. Even Vance had a comment. He's like, Trump won. We don't have to do this anymore. Florida Attorney General James told MLB, do you practice religious discrimination in Florida? You'll be hearing from my office soon. Senator Josh Hawley demanded answers from the commissioner. And this is what the MLB scrambled to add to their statement after the backlash. They said they'd given the same warning in the past to players for writing Dad, Happy Mother's Day, I love Mom, and names of family members. Writing on the cap violates the rules for everyone. Sure. And was the All-Star game pulled out of Georgia over Mother's Day message? Were players nationally condemned by their own team's front office for writing their father's name? The San Francisco Giants issued a statement saying the players' choices have caused pain and anger to many in the LGBTQ community. Pain and anger. Three men wrote the original meaning of a symbol that was taken from its creator, and the baseball team apologized for the pain this caused. I need those three men to know you are seen and what you did was right, and the rainbow belongs to God, and you said so on national television with a Sharpie and a cap you're required to wear, and I think that's courage. I think that's courage. I'm going to talk briefly about what's leaving and where it's going because the numbers tell a story that every Democrat governor in this country should have to answer to. New York, we knew what they voted for. New York, New York, we knew what they voted for. Fabulous, we're in TikTok jail. I knew that was coming. IRS migration data confirms that 892 companies have left New York State. $47 billion in income walked out the door. Florida gained 341 of those companies. Texas took 187. North Carolina added 129. New York, New York, New York, the state that keeps telling you progressive policy is good for business, the state where 892 employees calculated that the cost of operating under its government exceeded the benefit of staying. People and businesses vote with their feet. They vote with their relocation trucks, and IRS migration data doesn't care about political spin. It just shows where the money moved. And what's crazy to me, you guys, do you remember at one point Elon Musk once offered $6 billion to the World Food Program? That's the UN body that says that amount could end world hunger with one condition. He had one condition for them, that the accounting be made public. Show the world exactly how the money would be spent, and they declined. $6 billion to end world hunger, and they declined because they didn't want public accounting. The machine needs the problem to survive. The machine will always decline the solution if the solution comes with transparency. Do you see the game they're playing? Do you see why I get frustrated about us being useful idiots? Do you see why I want you to wake up and get involved and get off of social media and stop believing every influencer you see? I want you to fact check and fact check and fact check everybody and anybody. Do the research for yourself. Find some discernment, but unplug from the machine because they've just been taking advantage of you and you've just done everything they've wanted you to do. You're a puppet. I want to tell you about a man named Gideon. If you read Judges 6 and 7, you'll get the story. Come back to me. Israel had been under Midianite oppression for 7 years. Every harvest season, the Midianites would come like locusts, the text says, and destroy everything, every crop, every animal, every resource. Israel was so broken, they'd retreated to mountain caves and they're hiding in dens just to survive. God showed up to a man named Gideon while he was threshing wheat in a wine press, hiding from the Midianites. And God looked at this man hiding wheat in a hole in the ground and said, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." Gideon's response is one of the most honest moments, I think, in all of scripture. He said, "If the Lord is with us, why has all of this happened to us? Where are all the wonders our father told us about?" That is not faithlessness. That is a man who had been watching his country get destroyed for 7 years, asking the questions you and I have been asking for the last decade. If God is in this, if he is sovereign over this, where are the wonders? Why does the evil look like it keeps winning? God's answer was not an explanation, it was a commission. He said, "Go, I'm sending you. You will deliver Israel." Gideon said, "But my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family." God said one thing, he said, "I will be with you." And he was. But here's the part of the story that doesn't get preached about enough. Gideon gathered his army, 32,000 men. It wasn't enough to face the Midianite force. And then God said something that should stop you cold. He said, "You have too many men." Too many. God told Gideon his army was too large. He said, "If you win with 32,000, Israel will think they saved themselves. So send home whoever is afraid. 22,000 left, 10,000 remain." God said, "Still too many, you guys." He had Gideon take them down to the water and watched how they drank. The ones who cupped water in their hands and lapped it while staying alert, 300 of them, everyone else got down on all fours. He sent the rest home. Down to 300 men against what the Bible describes as an army like locusts, so many that they could not be counted. God said, "With these 300, I will deliver you." And here's what he gave them as weapons. It wasn't swords, it wasn't spears, it was torches. Torches hidden inside clay jars and trumpets. God's battle plan: surround the enemy camp at night. On my signal, break the jars, lift the torches, blow the trumpets, and shout. 300 people in the darkness, holding the light inside clay containers, waiting for the moment God said, "Now." When they broke the jars, when the light was suddenly revealed in every direction in the darkness, the Midianite camp erupted in panic. They turned on each other. They destroyed themselves. Israel didn't even have to fight. They just had to break the jars at the right moment and let the light out. I am talking to the people listening to this who feel like 300, who feel like the weakest clan and the weakest family, who are watching the locusts strip the harvest for wheat, what feels like 7 years, who are hiding in a wine press, doing what they can do just to survive. God's question for you is the same one he asked Gideon. What is in your hand? Not what army do you have, not how many followers, not how much money or influences or platform. What is in your hand right now? You have a voice, you have a vote, you have a seat at a local table that the Midianites are counting on being empty. You have 300 people in your community who are afraid and waiting for someone to say, now break the jar, let the light out. The jar is the thing you've been carrying the truth inside of. Waiting for it to be safe to say it, waiting for permission, waiting for someone else to go first. Break the jar. The light doesn't need your protection anymore. It needs to be seen. And the theme I keep coming back to in everything I've talked about right now is just this: make private lives private again. Your home, your children's bodies, your faith, your doctor's decisions, your community's resources, your vote's actual meaning, all of it has been invaded by activist teachers who grade children on performing same-sex kisses, by MLB executives who force their players to wear ideological symbols, by SPLC directors who decide which voices you're allowed to hear, by government systems corrupted by employees who see their job as advancing one group's pain at the expense of another. The Constitution does not give any of these institutions that authority it gives to you. And the only way they have it is because enough people don't show up to take it back. Show up in your school board, in your state legislature contact form, in your August primary, in your November general, in your life, lived visibility without apology, without hiding the torch inside the jar. 300 people who are serious change more than 32,000 who are going through the motions. This, everything. I mean, the terror plot we talked about, the 35 years, all the baseball stuff, all of this exists inside of a story that's already been written by someone who was there before any of it started. The God who set the rainbow in the clouds to mark his covenant, the God who took 300 men with torches and broke the most powerful army of their era, the God who told Gideon to his face that he was a mighty warrior while Gideon was literally hiding in a hole. He sees you exactly where you are, and he's not confused by what's happening. He has not lost control of the outcome. And if you've been watching this world and the feeling, the exhaustion and the frustration, and that exhaustion of someone who can see what's true and can't understand why it's not enough to change things, I want to say to you that exhaustion is not a sign that you're wrong. It's a sign that you're paying attention to something that matters, that you care enough to be tired. But care is not enough by itself. Neither is the correct information. Neither is righteous anger. What grounds all of this, what turns 32,000 into 300 who actually win, is the one who was in it before you got there. He's not waiting for you to figure it out. God is waiting for the culture. He's not waiting for the culture to be sorted. He's not waiting for the election results. He was before all things, and in him, all things hold together. If you've never given your life to Christ, if all of this reaching and searching and righteous fury has been looking for a foundation that doesn't move, I'm going to tell you it exists. It has existed and it's been there the whole time. So come to him. Not when you have it together, not when the country is fixed, but now, like you as you are, with everything you've seen and everywhere you've been and all the questions you still have. John 8:32, and you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. The truth is not a political party. It's not a candidate. It's not a podcast, including this one. It is a person, and his name is Jesus Christ. Make private lives private again. Make families sacred again. Make truth audible again. Make the light visible again. Break the jar. Faith, fire, God, country. Always.